This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. India's Narendra Modi continues his travels, visiting with his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, this week and becoming the first Indian Prime Minister to visit Israel. His visit comes just days after Mr. Modi was with Donald Trump at the White House and was photographed hugging the U.S. president warmly. Modi has come down firmly on the side of authoritarian and right-wing-leaning leaders. His foreign jaunts come at the same time as mass protests in Indian cities denounced anti-Muslim violence. The protests, dubbed hashtag not in my name, have received widespread news coverage undermining Modi's triumphant international photo ops. My guest is Beda Vrathopayan. He's an ex-NASA scientist and inventor of the digital camera technologies. He's an activist and now a filmmaker whose first film, Chittagong, won the Indian National Award as a best debut film. He's currently working on his next film in India, tentatively titled Disappeared. Welcome to the program, Beda.
Hi, how are you?
So first, let's start talking about what happened last week before we get into this week, which is Modi's visit with Trump. He went from visiting Trump to Netanyahu, so let's start with Trump. Modi's photos hugging Trump were ridiculed by some people in India who said, follow your prime minister and hug a beef eater. what do you make of Modi's seeming love affair with Trump? He was, right from the start when Trump was inaugurated, expressed his overt support for our president.
Well, you know, I mean, we were all kind of speculating here whether Trump will be modified or Modi will be Trumped. So we're not still sure with what happened.
So, go ahead.
It does look like it was a very strange visit, in my opinion. I mean, if you compare it with the visit last year when with President Obama, it was a very, very different feel to this visit. And even that hug, I would say that it was a rather awkward hug. It was not a, you know, like the kind of bonhomie that you saw with Prime Minister Netanyahu. That wasn't there. And, you know, perhaps a little bit of a history might be of use to put the whole thing in the right perspective. What do you think?
Yeah, and certainly given that Modi was at one time denied a visa to visit the U.S. before he became the Indian Prime Minister, and now years later is being welcomed in the White House. So yeah, give us some of that historical context of Modi's background and even his ability to come to the U.S.
Actually, well, that deal about Modi being denied visa and all that was reset in the last visit when there was this huge hoopla in Madison Square Garden and so on. So, Prime Minister Modi was welcomed very warmly in the U.S. last year. But I was actually going to talk more about the U.S.-India relations in the last 10 years or so, or a decade or so. Perhaps even starting with President Obama's second term, when that Asian pivot or rebalancing, whatever, was announced. And if you remember, in that, India was assigned a very, very important role. There was a talk of strategic partnership and so on. In fact, Leon Panetta, who was at that time the Secretary of Defense, this was in 2012, he said defense cooperation with India is a linchpin of this strategy of U.S. engagement in South Asia and Asia Pacific and so on. At that time, that is in 2012, that was still when the Congress government, which was not the current government, but the previous government led by Manmohan Singh was in power, and they refused to get drawn into that entire strategy. Of course, by that time, the Asian pivot and all fell out. But what happened is, in 2014, when the Congress government fell and the new right-wing government led by Narendra Modi came to power, almost immediately, there was an about-face in the Indian foreign policy. Indian kind of began, auditioning for the role of a U.S. sidekick. Of course, You know, it was not for any other reason but that India, Indian ruling circles, Indian power elite were thinking that by clutching onto the coattails of the US, it could become a big power. So very quickly, the Indo-US defense framework was drawn up. Then the LSA, the Logistics Support Agreement, was signed. And that was a very big deal. I mean, that would allow actually US to repair, refuel, replenish at Indian air and naval bases. I mean, this is something that has never happened in India with the US. So these were all signs of change times. Prime Minister Modi talked about increasing convergence in our strategic perspectives. Then came President Trump, and sort of all bets were off. We still don't quite know what his foreign policy is. I mean, there are a lot of unexpected one-off responses, like in North Korea or Syria, but it doesn't look like there is still a well-calibrated, thought-out foreign policy.
Now, the head of the Republican Hindu Coalition, Shalabh Shali Kumar, says that there is a shared political philosophy between Modi and Trump. And I don't know if that's code for a shared ability to foment mass Islamophobia. Is that what the two leaders might have in common?
It's difficult to say exactly what they have in common, and that's why I think this Trump-Modi meet was so interesting, because you did not hear so much talk about natural ally or defining partnership, which is what the Indo-US relationship, under Obama years and even before that in Bush years used to be called. So if there is a coordinated move along Islamophobia lines, it's not clear yet, but what was clear, and I think that's what I was coming to, that how the contrast between the 2016 and the 2017 visit, that where, it's a closed door meetings, no frills visit, a very wishy-washy joint statement, no questions were taken when they made the statement. And, pretty much it looks like Trump kind of gave Modi the cold shoulder. Without mincing any words, he basically said that American businesses are treated unfairly in India. Whether that's correct, right or wrong is another question. But the point is that his whole message to Modi seemed to be remove barriers to export of U.S. goods in India.
And so
that seemed to be the change that has happened, that it's no longer sort of the India being the cat's paw, the linchpin in the grand Asia Pacific strategy, but rather economic issues. And I think that being with Trump, when he went to Saudi Arabia, it was to ink a huge deal. And I think he's expecting that something similar would have happened with India. That's what it looks like to me.
So that's a huge contrast to Modi's meeting with Netanyahu this week. While there were similar photo ops in terms of the hugs between leaders, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu very warmly received Modi, said, "This is a marriage made in heaven, but we are implementing it here on earth." And the Modi and Netanyahu signed 7 agreements in sectors space technology, agriculture, etc. Yeah,
it's actually not agreements. These are memorandum of understanding. So, I mean, Indian press. They always want to beef it up more than it is, and probably beefing it up.
Yeah, let's talk about that later. But.
But that's what I was going to say, that the body language between Prime Minister Netanyahu and Prime Minister Modi was very, very different from what it was with Trump. Trump, it was, they're kind of trying to push that, oh, look, there's so much warmth. But here in Israel, there was definitely a real bonhomie that you could see.
And why is it that Modi became the first Indian prime minister to visit Israel? A tiny bit of historical context on that would be great as well.
Well, this is apparently this is done to celebrate 25 years of the establishment of official diplomatic relations between India and Israel. And of course, as you very rightly pointed out, he's the first prime minister to visit Israel. And what's more, I think what's more interesting is that this was the first time an Indian leader visited Western Asia. I don't like to call it Middle East, Western Asia, without visiting Palestine, without engaging with Palestine civil society in any shape or form. You know, last year or year before that, when the president of India went, I mean, he went to Palestine as well. He went to West Bank, but not Modi. And I think, you know, of course, all these MOU were signed on defense and space technology and water and agriculture, as you said. But I think the bigger issue is more of a geopolitical symbolism, more of the optics of the reorientation of Indian domestic politics to, I think, a more macho chauvinism and jingoism that we have seen in India in the last, that's been escalating in India in last, you know, certainly under Modi's regime. And I think that's what makes this Israel visit, you know, interesting and very disconcerting. Because, you know, a country that is known to the rest of the world for carrying out state terror and all kinds of, you know, denial of rights to Palestinians and occupation and, you know, attacks on schools and hospitals, that India should all of a sudden be having this kind of a bonhomie with their state of, you know, with that country, with that country's officials, is disconcerting for all progressive-minded Indians.
So let's talk about what's been happening in India since Modi's been traveling. There have been mass protests in cities in India that are saying, not in my name. What exactly are Indians denouncing? And what does it have to do with the kinds of policies we've seen unfolding in India under Modi?
There's one aspect of what has been happening under Modi, and the other aspect is what kind of actions from below is happening. And I think talking about the first, as I say that, I think in last year or so, there what we have seen in India is definitely an increase in this criminalization of dissent, in a very projection of this macho chauvinism, you know, going after Pakistan, going after China. I mean, even as we speak, there is a fracas going on between China and India, a border tension in, you know, involving India, Bhutan, and China. And I think along with that has come the other aspect, which is this definition of the term anti-national, that anybody that the powers that be doesn't like, they're named, labeled anti-national. And the media goes along with that. The mainstream media very much fuels that narrative. And then that person can be, all kinds of things can be done. Within that also comes attack against Muslims. This beef eating has become a very big issue in India.
And in fact, in some parts of India, it's banned now to consume beef, which has been used as a foil to lob attacks against Muslims and Dalits, right?
Correct. I mean, I think what I'm trying to say is that the issue is much more than just attack on Muslims, although that's a very obvious and open attack because, you know, I mean, you know, BJP, the party that Prime Minister Modi leads, it doesn't quite care about Muslim votes. And in that way, it's an easy target. But actually, the attack is on all Indians. Anybody who opposes the Modi regime comes under attack. You know, that goes from one hand from media houses like NDTV. There was such all of a sudden a raid on NDTV.
NDTV is one of the main TV networks in India.
It's one of the premier media networks of India. I mean, equivalent of CNN of India. And so all of a sudden there was an attack. Two university students who have been opposing Modi, and then they are they're arrested for just being anti-national. In fact, there is one student who's still missing, and the police is not investigating, and the government is refusing to provide any information of what happened to that person. So I think the the picture that I'm trying to bring up is that that the attack of this government is far wider and far bigger and far more profound than simply an attack on Muslims. Although that is very much there. An attack on Muslims, don't get me wrong, is very, very much part of the whole ballgame.
And so are you heartened by the protests, the Not In My Name protests?
So coming back to the protest, but before that, I just want to make one more point. And I think that the reason why this issue has become so important is because Modi government being very, very pro-business is and will take measures that will hurt people, from peasants to workers to women and so on. And I think a stage has been set where, or a stage is being set where anybody who opposes those policies will be called names and will be marginalized or put under bar, in the jail and so on. So I think that's the important thing to realize about Modi's India. Now, coming to the protests that are happening, and I think that's it's a very, very welcome thing, because unlike President Trump, in India, Prime Minister Modi has huge amounts of support. There is a lot of illusion that Modi will change the landscape of India. I mean, he's kind of the Trump's version of draining the swamp, which Modi has sold under the guise of Achhe Din, meaning good days are coming, or under the guise Sabka Vikas, Sabka Saath, everybody's development, everybody together.
So his version of Make America Great Again.
Yeah, so it's exactly the same kind of rhetoric. It's just that unlike President Trump, Prime Minister Modi has managed to convince the Indian populace, certainly the middle strata, in a very, very big way, that whatever he's doing is ultimately in the benefit. So just shut up and put up with it right now. And that's why the question of dissent becomes so important. So what has happened is that this Not In My Name movement that you saw happen in India in the last week was a very important thing for somebody to take a stand against these policies, to somebody to say that, no, we are not going to accept this. Although, in my opinion, the movement it was very limited, that it was only targeted to this beef, the lynching of Muslims or lynching of so-called beef eaters that have been happening. So in that sense, it was very limited. But the fact of the matter is that what is very healthy and what is very encouraging is that somebody gave the call to stand up and say no, and a large number of people responded. And I think that's a very, very healthy sign. It makes one very optimistic. But at the same time, I think that what needs to happen in India is to expand the base of that movement, that it actually has to be framed in terms of it's an attack on everybody's rights. That it's not just Hindu versus Muslims. It's not just that some minorities are being attacked. Anybody who opposes will be attacked. I mean, in that sense, one hates to do it. One absolutely hates to do it, but comparison with sort of Nazification is probably more apt, where any kind of dissent was dealt with in a very, very authoritarian way.
Finally, Bedabratha, let's talk also about some of the financial policies under Modi, because that was a big part of his promise to Indians. And one of the things that he's taking up right now is replacing a patchwork of taxes, city, state-level taxes, with one single sales tax, general sales tax across India. And this comes, less than a year after his radical so-called demonetization scheme, where a number of types of currency was simply banned in India, which many argued disproportionately hurt poor Indians. How radical is what he is proposing with taxes? And the second part of the question is, how has demonetization played out?
Oh boy, you're again asking a lot of questions, wide-ranging questions. You know, I actually was in India, as it turned out, both demonetization and GST, the goods and service tax, the one India one tax thing, happened as soon as I arrived in India. It looks like every time I come in India, Modi does something. So I think I gotta stop coming to India. That's the conclusion I come to. But jokes aside, you know, demonetization at that time was really affected the poor. It did not affect the rich. It did not affect the upwardly mobile middle class as much. Because
Did it have any impact on corruption, which was supposedly the goal?
Well, I mean, we should probably do a separate segment on that. To this date, we have not a single person of large, you know, somebody who has huge amounts of corruption, who have been brought under you know, who have been arrested or case has been made against them or anything. Because we knew even at that time that only a small fraction of this, what we call black money or this kickbacks and you know, the parallel economy is in cash. 95 to 96% of that is actually not in cash. It's in various other things and very often sitting in tax havens in all over the world. So demonetization, you know, from everything that we see, has nothing really to do with catching the corrupt people. It's to actually, if you take a broader view of both of this GST, goods and service tax, and demonetization, it is to create infrastructure for Indian capital to and international capital to merge. That is, for international capital to easily come to India. I mean, don't forget, the GST is a part of WTO. It's not something that Modi has dreamt up. It was very much a demand of the WTO. So it's all to do with facilitating foreign capital coming into India and for Indian big businesses to get access to the to foreign markets and so on, and to forge partnerships with international capital. So all this is being done in the final analysis to maximize the profit of Indian businesses as well as of the international capital that it might be able to bring in India. Because after all, India, you know, whether you look at defense or in infrastructure, there's huge amounts of expenditure that could happen. And the question is, who's going to get those fact checks? So I think the point I'm trying to make is that there has been a thinking within the Indian ruling circles and the big businesses or the corporates is that India needs to become a big power. And how are they going to do that? Well, they would need to beef up their military side, and that's been happening. And that's where the jingoism and chauvinism comes in. And on the other side, you have the economic side, where you want to create mechanisms and institutions such that foreign capital can easily come to India and Indian businesses can easily you know, get access to the world markets. And that's what, honestly, what Prime Minister Modi is trying to facilitate. Along with that, of course, comes stuff that is going to come along the way, which is labor law reforms, privatization. I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, the whole world, when it has come to reject neoliberalism, thanks to the experience in UK, in Europe, in the US, in Latin America, precisely at that point, the Indians are jumping on the bandwagon of neoliberalism. You know, somebody got to shake up Indians and say, hey, look at the experience of the rest of the world. And it's not very great. And I think that's where India is kind of still caught in a time warp. Many people say that India has always been caught in a time warp, but now it looks like it's caught in a new time.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and helping us put these issues into context. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sonali. It was great talking to you.
My guest is Beda Bratto Pine. He's an ex-NASA scientist, inventor of the digital camera technologies, an activist, and now a filmmaker. His first film, Chittagong, based on a forgotten uprising, won the Indian National Award as Best Debut Film. You can actually watch it on Netflix. He's currently working on his next film in India, tentatively titled Disappeared. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.